Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Telling you, bro. It's been happening, bro.
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and welcome to the Riff Raff. Stories and insights from the front lines. My guest today is Mr. Will Lee. What can you say about Will Lee that hasn't already been said? I mean, he's one of the most recorded bassists of all time. He's appeared on over 1,000 records. He hit the ground running in New York City after landing the gig with Dreams with the Brecker Brothers and Billy Cobham at age 18, and he hasn't stopped since. He's a really talented singer and sang on many jingles that you probably didn't even realize was him singing. And even if you haven't heard Will on records, which is highly unlikely, I'm sure it's not possible, you've undoubtedly seen him in your living room night after night as a member of the world's most dangerous band on Late Night with David Letterman. A gig he held for a stunning 30 years. Will's a really positive and forward-thinking person, as you'll hear. His enthusiasm for music and his love of the Beatles is fully evident. In this interview, I ask Will a lot of questions. He provides some great and oftentimes amusing answers, too. We talk about the scene in New York City, then and now, Steve Gadd, Hiram Bullock, the Beatles. He demonstrates some grooves. We play the late night theme together, Jaco, Steely Dan sessions, and much, much more. Oh, and we do quite a bit of jamming at the end. There was so much great stuff in this that I decided to include a bit of bonus material at the end if you're so inclined to keep listening. And there's some really beneficial advice Will shares for musicians. I'm walking over to Will's now, go up to his beautiful apartment, killer studio, basses everywhere, Beatles memorabilia everywhere. All right, here we go. I sit down with my guitar, and Will hands me a pretty unusual guitar cable to plug into.
Is it custom made for Paul Schaefer?
No, this one's custom made for Biff Henderson.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, you're comfortable? Good. It's your house, you know, of course you're comfortable.
Yeah, man. You know, there are podcasts and there are podcasts, but there's only one Riff Raff with Shane Terrio, ladies and gentlemen.
Now, wait a minute, you did some prep work, or you thought about that. All right, Will, hey man, thank you for doing this.
My pleasure. Yeah. And thank you for doing it at 2:30. Which
you thought was a funny time.
It makes sense to me. I've had a lot of dental work done. So tooth hurdy.
Oh, I see.
Kind of feels like it at home to me.
I thought 14:30 was more, you know.
That's very funny. Cool, but that's a military. Yeah. It kind of makes me think I'm in the Navy all of a sudden. Which is all right. In the Navy. Riff, 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 riff,
Man, I don't even know where to start. You know, it's like as soon as I walk in here and see all your amazing bases and all the memorabilia, and I don't even know where to start. We're sitting in Will's, this is your studio. It's basically a Beatles museum.
It is. That's the name of the
you
studio.
You have every actually. Lunchbox in chronological order, proper Beatles album order, looks like.
Yes, all the albums are represented by a lunchbox, including... There's another one that was the original sort of Beatle fan item. And that's why this is called the Beatles Museum, by the way.
I
was always fascinated
together.
By the amount of merch that, you know, you attach the Beatles name to, and you'd feel like you had a piece of the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
The Beatles didn't get a piece of the merch profit, but
that didn't,
the fans had it.
Nobody got hip to that until probably Bill Graham and Grateful Dead.
And Kiss, for sure.
Oh, Kiss, yeah. Yeah.
They've got a huge merchandise business going. I mean, it's unbelievable with those guys. They've got pinball machines, more than one, multiple ones. There's a new one. They've got, I asked Gene Simmons, what's the most amazing Kiss merchandise that's out there? He said, well, there's the coffin. There's the urn. And then he showed me 100 new products that are just out in Japan where Hello Kitty and Kiss merged and did a thing, you know?
Wow.
With all these, the kitty wearing Kiss makeup stuff. It's incredible.
That makes sense. I could see that. Gene probably owns the trademarks on everything. I heard he trademarked Ace Frehley's likeness, name and likeness, and owns
his name.
He owns it, yeah.
Ace Frehley is owned by Gene Simmons.
That's what I've heard. Like somewhere,
you know, it's a lawyer's world we live in.
And he tried to trademark OJ, the letters OJ, like orange juice.
He did.
Almost got away with it.
That's incredible.
I don't know if that's actual truth or not.
I'm going to trademark That's Incredible just in case. I already have thatsincredible.com. I've got that domain name. No, not at all. I'm not one of those kind of guys.
We met a few years ago, but we got to play a couple times, a little bit.
Did we run into each other backstage at a Styx concert?
No. We ran into each other backstage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards. You were playing in the house band.
Yeah, we did most of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably, God, how many have there been? I mean, I think we've done 25, 26, 27 of those. And it's been kind of a thrilling ride, because when you look back and see people that are, you know, they were legends then, and they've been gone a long time since.
Yeah,
just you can't even, you know, you look at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum and see all the people that are in there, and those are the people that we played with, basically.
Yeah, well, you've played with pretty much everybody, man. But you know what I was thinking when we set this interview up was, the day we ran into each other at the hat shop, our mutual friend Jennifer's hat store, and you were saying,
Jennifer Willett, amazing.
Yes.
Amazing milliner.
Amazing hats. I recommend highly. And you were saying, man, you should come out Monday night. I'm playing with Oz and Bernard Purdy. And you said, Oz Noy, great guitar player, said, I want to do all this Boogaloo stuff. And you told me, well, I told Oz, well, you know who played on all those records? It was me and Bernard.
Not all those records, but the records that he was focusing on at the time. Like, some of them were like Dr. Lonnie Smith.
Dr. Lonnie Smith. Okay, that's what I was thinking of. And then when I left that night, I was thinking, Will could not possibly be old enough to play. Like, it's unbelievable, your discography. I mean, anybody that knows, you know, musicians know who you are. They know, common knowledge. But the depth of everybody you've played with, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Well, it's being in New York, you know, a huge part of that. That's really number one. It's just being there and available and having people recommend you, of course. And when I first got to town, I thought I was going to leave after the band that I came to join, which was called Dreams,
yep,
with Billy Cobham and the Brecker Brothers and Don Grolnick and Bob Mann and all these amazing musicians. And I thought, the band is ending, so I'm going to go back to Miami. And I had two friends that were associated with that band. One of them was Bob Mann, and his housemate at the time was Alan Schwartzberg, this wonderful drummer, who were involved with the studio world to the point where I had seen some sessions happen. And quite frankly, I never dreamed of being a part of the scene, because I had looked at it and seen how sewn up the whole deal was. And I thought, okay, this is something, this is really incredible. This is something that there's probably a huge, of course, there's a huge waiting list for people to get into this world. And I'm not in on the list. So I've never even aspired for 1 second to be a part of it, because I thought I see how sewn up this is. And I was ready to leave town at the end of the Dreams run. And these guys, Bob Mann and Alan Schwarzberg, who shared a house up in Nyack, said, no, you're not leaving. We're going to get you. You're going to stay at our house and we're going to get you work. And I thought, sure enough, they started getting me gigs. I got on this singing and playing commercial that Bob Mann was the arranger for Kentucky Fried Chicken. And next thing you know, I was part of that particular Jingle House, which was huge at the time. Mm-hmm. Susan Hamilton was the producer for Hermony Dell Associates, HEA. And I was singing this commercial, and I guess I did good enough that they asked me to sing another one and play another one, and then another one, and another one, and another one. And I had guys who were mentors in the studio, because I was very naive and very wide. I didn't know what I was doing, really, but I was had a little reading skills, and when everybody else was outside joking around, I was inside penciling in the note names on the musical scores, so I would know, you know, where to put my fingers when the guy counted it off, and the click started running. And some really encouraging drummers, Bill Lavornia, who used to play with Liza Minnelli, was on a lot of these really great, super musical reading sessions that for that particular house, Jingle House, and another guy named Ronnie Zito. And those guys were, between those guys, you know, if you're a bassist, your biggest ally and you're always sat next to is the drummer.
Sure.
Yeah. In these situations. And those are the guys who were the most encouraging, and because they could be. They were the proximity of where we were sitting next to each other. And I'd be like, whoa, what do you do? And he, well, you just follow me, kind of, you know. And then I learned that the reason that I was able to get into the studio world in the first place was because of availability. You know, I was just the guy who had nothing else going on, but I was starting to get a little name for myself. And the fact that I was available was a big deal. That was a big part of it, because the reason I was slotted into these sessions was that somebody else couldn't make it. Mm. When I figured that out, I thought, well, nobody's ever going to know that I'm unavailable for a session. So I would do things like, we got on the road with Bette Midler for her first national tour. Mm-hmm. Barry Manilow was the musical director, was her musical director. I would get a call for a jingle while we're out somewhere in the middle of America, and I would say yes, and I would fly back for this 30-minute thing, and then get my ass back out there in middle America for that night's Bette Midler show, you know? Because I didn't want anybody to think for 1 second that I was out of town.
Even then, there was a stigma of road guy and touring versus studio. And once they call you once or twice and you're not available, then that's it, right?
Yeah.
You're off the list.
Either
you move down the list.
Yes. Oh, let's not use him anymore. He's moved to Brooklyn, you know. Mm-hmm. So, A, you had to be in Manhattan. And, B, you had to be able to do something in a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. So basically that meant you had to have a 212 phone number.
But, you know, even having those qualities, I mean, there's a lot of things. Like your sight reading ability on bass, did you have the sight reading chops when you first moved to New York? Or did you, I mean, you were probably a good reader when you moved here,
I had
right?
been a trumpet player
and so
majored
there
in French
horn. There was an advantage right there.
In
yeah,
college. So I knew the note values. And for bass, I was still getting my way around bass clef.
Yeah.
But I would take the time, like I said before, to pencil those note names in, you know. I mean, a lot of these we're talking about sometimes 30-second pieces of music.
Yeah.
You know, especially with the jingle stuff. But the record stuff, a lot of it wasn't reading, you know. And you were also allowed to make your own kind of chart.
Yeah, it's more creative. You have to pull from your own creativity. And
sure. And, of course, my own creativity, besides the fact that my parents were amazing jazz musicians, which gave me a sense of feel from day one, was the fact that, you know, I had listened so frequently to my record collection, you know, and I was really married to being in my room and putting on Steve Miller's Brave New World album or, you know, whatever Motown stuff was going on. And, of course, and above all, the Beatles stuff. Mm-hmm. I should have a wristband made. What would the Beatles do? You know, because that was the kind
yeah,
of thing.
It's such a huge part of.
Yeah, no matter what kind of music we're talking about, whether it was gospel or country or R&B or just rock and roll or anything, the Beatles always had some information for me to feed from. If it was a legit, you know, big bandy sounding thing, I could refer to when I'm 64, you know. Or any of those sort of more legitimate Paul McCartney, you know, compositions and stuff. But they all gave me a reference point to bounce off of. And it's sort of been the underlying thread throughout my entire career is the Beatles, basically.
It's interesting. And you hear it nowadays. If you hear something on the radio, every other song people have pulled from the Beatles, the drum sounds, the bass parts, the woofy bass things.
They changed everything.
You know,
they changed all of pop music.
Yeah.
They took a huge right turn with pop music way back when things were pretty fairly kind of black and white as compared to the colors that they added to the sonic spectrum for us.
Well, let's go back and talk about Dreams. Is it true that, did Randy Brecker hook you up with that audition, or how did you, I mean, because you were like, what, 19 years old?
I was 18.
18. In Miami, University of Miami, where your dad was the dean of music, right?
Yep. University of Miami. Yeah. Dean. Yeah. For like 20
Pretty
years.
Pretty fertile ground back then, probably, right? There were a lot of great musicians back then.
Yeah. I mean, he was responsible for getting guys like Pat Metheny into the school. You know, he actually literally went to a club in Kansas City and heard Pat's play and said, how would you like a scholarship to the University of Miami? And he said, I'd love it, but I couldn't afford it. And he goes, well, yes, you can, because I've given you one right
now.
You know, that's the kind of guy my dad was. Wow. It was pretty fertile, you know. We were experimenting with a lot of things back then, if you know what I mean. A lot of chemistry. You know, we were teenagers. So we were looking into, okay, so what do you ingest? What can I ingest next into my body to get myself completely altered? And meanwhile, a big part of my musical life was dictated by the fact that I was playing rock and roll in clubs at night and studying jazz at the university in the daytime. So for me, when the band Dreams hit the scene, of all the sort of horn jazz rock bands that were out, and that would include Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, you know, all the offshoots like Lighthouse and Ides of March or whatever, there was this band Dreams that had a particularly special level of musicianship, you know, between Mike Brecker and Randy and Billy Cobham and these guys. What you heard was something that was really such a great mix of pop and jazz, you know, in one place at one time, that for my little world, which was that in-between place, for instance, I love when people in the jazz world think I'm a rocker and people in the rock world think I'm a jazzer. I just love that. You know, I hate to be pinpointed. Oh, he just does that one thing. Those people in my life, you know, that were big Dreams fans, to the point where I thought maybe the Dreams were like the next Beatles, you know. They were huge in our lives. And therefore, I knew their music like backwards and forwards. So when I came up to audition, I had got this call from Randy Brecker saying, can you come to New York and audition for this band Dreams? And I was like, how does he know about me? And it turns out that a guy who had guest lectured at the university one day jammed together, and he goes back and tells these guys about this kid in Miami that he thinks would be great for the band Dreams, because they were losing their bassist Chuck Rainey at the time.
Wow.
Thank God I didn't know who he was. Or I would never have taken a chance. So I go up, I nail the audition, and now I'm a New York guy all of a sudden. And I had never thought about New York for 5 seconds. You know, wow. I was in eight bands at
what
the time.
What was that
in
day
Miami.
Like, the audition, where you say you nailed it, so you mustn't have been that nervous. Were you nervous?
I was nervous up until the very moment that Billy Cobham counted it off and started to play. At that point, I was just floating.
Yeah.
Because I had never experienced anything like what that felt like. I mean, I was used to kind of being the timekeeper in bands, you know, like stomping my foot twice as hard as anybody else on stage to try to keep things moving along at the right pace, you know. But with Billy, there was nothing for me to do.
Wow.
And the fact that I sang was a plus for those guys, because Clive Davis, record company president, was pressuring them to be more commercial and wanted us, you know.
Sure.
So the idea that I sang was like, ooh, he sings, you know.
Yeah, a little icing. Yeah, a little extra. And then so you get the gig, and man, all your friends in Miami must have just been won the lottery or something.
Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, I was this really important guy who made it.
Isn't that funny, man, the way people perceive things?
It's something
they can attach something to. I mean, you played the exact same as you did the day before, but you know, all of a sudden, you're a cat, you know?
Yeah, now I have a really hip place to put my talents to use.
Yeah.
So that was really fun.
Now you've played with, let's see, Paul McCartney. You played with George Harrison. You played with, I don't know if you played with John Lennon.
I did, but he wasn't in the room at the same time.
Oh, okay.
It was on
Imagine
Ringo's
or,
record.
Oh, Ringo's,
it was on Ringo's album.
All right. And well, that almost counts. So
kind of. John had played his keyboard part already.
Wow.
And then I came in and overdubbed bass.
I mean, to come from Fort Worth, Texas, man, and be, you know, obviously you're so super passionate about the Beatles, and then to have worked with all of them, and what, regardless of whatever capacity, pretty amazing. And the story you just told me about the bass, you know, with McCartney, and I don't know if you want to talk about that on here.
I haven't made that public, but
yeah.
I recently was able to give Paul a bass, which he needed, and, you know, for me to give him something, for him to need something from me, is like unbelievable, you know.
Yeah,
so that was really
such a beautiful thing, man. Beautiful,
he's
bass.
A beautiful human being. Unbelievable. I mean, I can't say enough words about Paul McCartney.
Yeah,
you know.
I don't know anybody that's been able to do that. Play bass, and there's a few people. Jim Keltner, maybe. I mean, it's not a lot of people, man. That's. And then the discography. I mean, this is a difficult one because there's so much stuff you've done, man.
In the words of Joe Walsh, life's been good.
Yeah,
so far.
I would say. So I'd rather ask you like some other crazy shit, because if people ask you,
I like crazy shit.
It's all been documented many times. But you know, is it true that you went to play on Stratus and you ended up not playing on Stratus? Is that true? That's got to be the only time that's ever happened in your whole career.
Well, you know, at the time, let me think about this, how this happened. I think Billy Cobham was still in dreams for that moment before he completely, God, I may be wrong about this. He might have left dreams at this point. I think he had left dreams and had started working with Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in the studio. He said, I'm trying to get a record deal. Can you come in and record some tunes with me? And he had asked Jan Hammer and John Abercrombie also. So we go in and we record four songs, and they were burning. And
wow.
It was Stratus, and it was Tarian Matador, and another song called Quadrant 4, and one other song that I can't remember. And I had the tapes for the longest time. I don't know what happened to it. But so that's the tape that got him the deal with Atlantic Records, and he said, can you know, I got the deal, we're going to record such and such a week on such and such a month. And I thought, this is great, I can't wait till he tells me exactly when. I'll put it in my book and we'll do the thing and it'll be great. So just by coincidence, I lived close to Electric Lady Studio, and every once in a while I would pop in and say hello to Lourdes, the girl who I think eventually married Mark Knopfler, but she was the studio receptionist at the time. And I would just love to see what's going on over there, because I knew one of the house, a guy who worked there a lot, engineer Ron, Ron, who pre-Kiss was trying to get Kiss a record deal. They were called Wicked Lester. He never got him the deal, but he tried. Ron Johnson. And so back in Studio B, they would be working, and Studio A, what's going on in A? Hey, let me open the door. Open the door, and Billy Cobham is recording these songs with another band, except Jan Hammer is there. Different guitar player, different bass player. And I was like, I was completely crushed. Like what did I do wrong? And I didn't talk to Billy for 20, 30 years.
Wow.
After that, I was just couldn't even look
at
him.
You never got a reason
think
why.
About him. Huh?
You never got a reason why, Ernie?
I still don't understand what it was, you know. But whatever it was, it's gone. And it's, I don't know what the politics of all these things that happen are. You know, I don't know if it was somebody had a friend in the bassist that ended up doing the record. He and I are great friends, but it was Lee Sklar.
Who knows back then?
Yeah, who knows?
Whatever. It could have been, a record company thing. It could have been whatever.
But I'm fine with it.
It's the one record. I mean, yeah, I played with all the Beatles, but you know, that one thing. Did you ever think about, have you ever counted how many episodes of Letterman Show you did?
Between NBC and CBS, I wish I knew the number. I'm sure that's well documented too, but I don't know. It's in the 5, 6, 9 thousands. I don't know. Somewhere between 5 and 9 thousand. I don't know.
And you would show up. I actually played on the show a couple of times with guest artists and stuff, you know, come in, do the little song and leave. And it was always freezing cold in there, man.
It was frozen.
Freezing cold, you know.
Yeah, we actually had to lobby for like about 6 years before we finally got some heaters over
really?
Us. Really? And it's crazy because just, think about the horn players.
Yeah, trying
you
to
know,
keep
every
things
day,
in tune.
A guy like Tom Malone walks in and he's got a trumpet behind him. He's got some saxophone, some flutes and a trombone, and he's got to pick each one up like spontaneously while it's cold and just play music on the thing in this temperature situation. That's kind of impossible. I mean, I've heard a lot of string players complain because strings were always situated back where it was the coldest in that room, toward the back of the stage.
Makes sense.
That's where all that cold air was coming from. At one point, our techie Mike Ferrante had guitar picks printed up that had the Late Show logo on one side. You flip it over, it said 47 degrees. 47 and the little degree sign. I wish I had one of these. I might actually have a huge pick collection, which I'm very proud of. Someday I'm going to figure out a way to publish it.
I have one of your picks. It says Uncle Will on the back. I don't remember where I got it from. I've had it for years. The original incarnation of that band was you, Steve Jordan, and Hiram, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hiram Mullock. That was a lot of people love that band.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was the band that had been the 24th Street band.
Right.
So that was a ready-made band. So Schaefer just kind of brought us in, and we kind of knew what to do immediately. Which was great because the moment that he informed us that there was a show to do and can we be a part of it was 1 week before the whole thing started.
Wow.
Well, let's get together and learn some songs then, you know. And we got together that night and started hitting it. You know, started. Like,
now, how
learning.
Long had you been in New York at that point when that gig, when you landed that gig, that ended up being a 30-year run for you?
That was, I'd been here for... That was my 11th year in town because I came here in 71, and that was February of 82 when that happened. But I got to learn how to do a bunch of stuff. I mean, we had a quartet, and we were trying to get close to the records. So we would end up having to do stuff like, you know, we were trying to make it sound complete, so we would have to go.
Why, Why would you do that? Just to add more meat to the arrangement?
On the record, there's an actual bass part that goes. Once the song goes, gets started, right? But the bass voice keep going, we weren't singing. We were just an instrumental band at the time. So we had to figure out ways to do things like, I don't know if you ever listened closely to Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, but there's two basses. And one bass is going like, right?
Yeah.
And one bass is going.
The thirds.
So I had to figure out how to go. Right? Sorry, I'm sitting in a weird position. So that was, there was,
I didn't realize
like
it was a contrary motion thing going on. I thought it was just
two upright basses.
I thought it was just these, you know, thirds.
No, if you listen, it's got that contrary motion. So, you know, we had to figure out ways of filling in the blanks as a quartet because we were really trying to go for stuff. And a lot of the stuff that we ended up doing in those early days ended up being like trying to find an ending for a Beatles song, for example. A lot of that stuff actually transferred itself over into Fab Four with the Beatles band that I have. Then we tried to figure out how to get out of a song, and sometimes it would come in handy to use Paul Schaefer's endings for stuff. And one of the great ones, one of the really fun ones, was that he had us all learn the Paul McCartney tax band solo. Right.
Yeah.
And that's how we would end the song. And I lobbied and lobbied to try to get Fab Four to do that as an ending, but they talked me out of it. But anyway,
so kind of talking what you're saying, like just having fun with the gig and
it was
taking
fun.
Chances.
And it was fun because Paul Schaefer allowed me so much freedom, and he never made me play the theme twice the same, ever. He just let me do anything I wanted to with it. As long as it kind of established a little, some kind of a shuffly thing. Because it started out, his concept was, okay, well, the show comes on at 12:30 at night at the time, in the early days. That's pretty late. So we got to make it a little sleepy. It can't be too, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, it's party time. Come on, wake up, get out of bed. It was more like, okay, we're going to ease you into your evening. So it's always.
Yeah, some slinkier. Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know. So once we kind of were able to establish any kind of a thing, we would, let's see, say the groove was like, right? So once we got that, you know, we established what that was. I could play if I wanted to play Sex Machine by Sly and the Family Stone underneath that.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, I don't know.
Whatever I could dream of, you know,
right.
It's just like silly or stupid or fun or cool or corny. It was all good.
As long as it grooves, which it always does.
We've had some good drummers. You know, we started with Steve. And then Steve left, and we got Anton. And my big Anton discovery was in the studio with him with Ace Frehley doing that first his solo record, which was a huge wake up call. Like, who is this guy? You know, and why is he talking so funny?
Of course,
it was exciting. Eddie Kramer was the engineer slash producer of that record. There was a studio called Plaza that was right above Radio City. And during their breaks, the Rockettes would like peer through the window at us like we were huge rock stars. I mean, there I was with Ace Frehley. So I guess in a way we sort of were, because he was, you know, Kiss was so huge.
Wow, man. Yeah.
So I felt like, you know, one tiny iota of what the Beatles must have felt like at the moment that they were recording She Loves You, you know, where Abbey Road was surrounded by screaming, you know, babes. Out that's of all why the, I got into music.
That's why all, everybody gets into music. Every teenage boy, I think. Riff-raff. Now, you and Steve Gadd have a long, long, long history.
Yeah. Well, Steve is a cool customer. Yes, we've been through it, and that came out alive, and yeah, and now we're living.
How many records do you think you and Gadd have done?
Man,
hundreds.
I have no idea. Not nearly enough for my taste. He's one of those guys that I was bouncing around in the waves down in St. Bart's the other day with a guy who's another drummer, Doug Yole, and I was telling him the story of, you know, I was just kind of posing this universal question: what is it about Steve Gadd? What is it with Steve Gadd? What is it with this guy? You know, what is it? It's hard to say what it is. I mean, there's a combination of things that go into a guy like his playing, and one of them is, it doesn't matter the distance between any two of his notes. That once he establishes that first note, the second note is going to be right where you want it to be and right where you're hoping it's going to be and right where you feel like yourself, right where you feel it. Somehow it's going to be at that place. So that gives you the ability to really land together, you know, and once you understand that about Steve Gadd, your job becomes so easy because he just puts it down in that place that you want it to be, you know. And I remember there was a session, there was many sessions, but there was one in particular where he didn't come in for a long time. He didn't show up for the date for a long time. And we sat around trying to get our parts together. And man, I couldn't come up with anything for this particular song. But the second he showed up and sat down on that drummer's stool, counted it off and started to play, my shit came like instantly. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly what to play. You know, my part made me sound like a genius all of a sudden. And before I was fishing and nothing worked and like, what am I doing? And why am I even here? And they should have called somebody who can play. I can't play, you know, but man,
if you had to think of a signature track that you and Gadd did together, I'm sure there are many, but something that pops into your head or one or two or
well,
something.
There was a thing that most people don't even know about. And it was really an obscure record that we both, you know, it's really the only record that we ever sat down and listened to again and again together after it was said and after it was all done. We never really returned to any of our other stuff that we ever did, but there's this one project. It was the Manhattan, the New York Community Choir. And it was a gospel record, and it was arranged by Leon Pendarvis, and Richard T was on. I was on. Jeff Mironoff, I think, played most of the guitar, and there were two albums. And Steve and I were the rhythm section, were the bass and drums for that stuff. And man, we just love going back and listening to that stuff. It's awesome.
What if I could find that?
Yeah, you can find it here and there. There's one song, I think it's called, either Express Yourself or Release Yourself. Man, it's really killing. It's killing.
any other signature grooves that you've done with Gad? Like,
if well, you know, I mean, this got way overused. I mean, we sat down and we would play these grooves that just sounded like this, you know.
Yeah, that's on his instructional right? video. Yeah,
that's even on the. Yeah. It even made it to the video.
Yeah,
but you know, whatever that is, that became like. I keep forgetting nothing up anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I keep whatever. I'm way out of tune. Anyway, so that was like a signature Steve thing. I don't know where that started. I don't know if it started with stuff. I don't
it sounds so New Steve. York, man. When you hear that, it's like, yeah. It sounds New York.
It turned into, it became quite a cliche. I mean, you want to avoid it as much as much as
possible. Yeah.
You know, I guess there's a lot of records where that shows up. Uh-huh. You know, I don't know where we placed it. We put it here and there, and then I think we put it on some Alessi stuff and maybe some, I don't even know. I just keep remembering that, okay, we did that already. We got to do something else.
Another record I had that I wore out was Hearts and Numbers.
Mm.
One of my favorites.
It had Don some drummers Grohl, on there.
Two drummers at one time. Mm. Was it Erskine and
Human
Steve,
Bites? Or...
It was Steve Jordan, right?
Yeah.
Drums were panned, hard right and left. But the signature, man, of all of that stuff, for me, like when I think of one of your tracks, is Pools.
Mm.
That bass part, which maybe it was even written, I don't know, but the way you played
it. Yeah, it was written.
Yeah, the way you played it, it's killer.
I wish I could have played it better.
That's
because nobody felt it the way Gralnick felt it. He just had this great ability to phrase things, and he wrote the song around boop 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 boop, and where he put that boop 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 was in such a place that it still I find it challenging to try to emulate him doing it. He taught me how to play triplets. Triplets is a really special area that people really don't. Not many people know how to play a triplet, and triplets get confused with, like, if you're in a tempo that's like, say,
right.
The temptation to play a triplet, a lot of people will want to play something that's like not a triplet, but more like. Boom, 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 right? Boom.
Quarter note triplet with an accent on.
Almost like that.
Straight.
Which is nothing like what a triplet is, because a triplet is an even thing. And Gralnick taught me how to, like I'm going to hold my left hand about 8 inches above my knee, and I'm going to play on my knee the Gralnick triplet. And you gotta like use your hand to play, to go back and forth between that hand that's hovering over the knee and the knee. And it would be like.
Ah.
So you gotta have that. You gotta have that secondary. You gotta have that secondary slap in between the triplets to let you know that you're doing it evenly.
I see.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's the guy that taught me how to really feel a triplet well, you know, instead of mistakenly playing it that other way. Nice and round, you know. And that kind of, and just the feeling of that can really sum up Gralnick's whole lifestyle in a way, his whole musical lifestyle. Because he really... You know, everything about his musical choices was so natural and so unforced and so unpretentious. I mean, James Taylor called him the truth. When James Taylor spoke about him, he would say, I looked to Gralnick for the truth, you know, because Gralnick was always about, I mean, he could bullshit, but not in a way that was, he wasn't skirting the issue. He was just, he would do it for a laugh or for whatever. But when it got down to business, Gralnick always knew what was right or wrong about stuff, especially music, you know?
Wow. That's yeah, a just very great, special great guy. Story, man.
Mr. Natural.
I love that record, Hearts and Numbers. You guys check that record out. It's classic.
I love the song Four Sleepers on it. Yeah. I didn't play it. I think Marcus played on that, but boy, that's my favorite.
When Gralnick. You cut that record on the sessions, were they tracking with two drummers or was it overdubbed?
I think so. I think they were both there.
I have to be, man, an interplay like that. I remember somebody told me they had done a session with Steve Jordan once, and he said, man, he never, like, he just played straight time. He didn't play a fill. He didn't even hit a crash cymbal, nothing. Like, 3 minutes into the tune, the tune's almost over, and he does his fill, hits a crash, and everybody's like, wow! You know, it's just...
And it really means something
really
at that
meant
point.
Something, yeah. You know, a lot of bass players, too, the note duration and the way people hold the notes out, even a simple part. It's like, you know, it's sort of like analogous to taking a dart and throwing, you know, landing it the right way.
Yeah, when you let go of the note, that has a really strong feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's important. That's an important part of the groove.
Mm-hmm. So you're conscious of that all the time. I mean, you don't have to think about this stuff anymore. It's just innate at this point, but...
I do. I mean, I love when writers, when arrangers write out a chart and they have the note length like spelled out for you so you can know exactly what their intent is. They'll have a long mark over it or a short mark over it, or, you know, they'll say, you know, they'll want it either full value or they'll write out exactly when they want you to release it and stuff by putting rests in the way. Because that's such an important part of... You know, music, I think a lot about a guy, you know, Tom Wolk.
Yeah, you know, T-Bone. He comes up in every episode. People bring him up on every episode.
He was a wonder, man. He was an amazing guy with all that stuff we're talking about.
And you got him his first recording session.
Yeah, inadvertently, just by not showing up, not being able to do it. I ended up singing on the thing. And when I came in later to sing it, and I go, well, how'd the guy do? And I listened to his track, and I said... What am I hearing? Can you solo that for me? What is that? Gorgeous sound. I couldn't believe it, you know?
Wow.
Couldn't believe, like, everything about it was exactly what I would have wanted to do if I could have done it, and I still don't know how to do it, but...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was so beautiful.
What was that session? Was commercial. It just a little jingle thing?
Yeah.
Riff-raff. I know you and Hiram Bullock, man, had this, like, connection, you know, and what do you think, besides him being an awesome musician overall, I mean, what made it click, do you think? What did you like about...
You know, Hiram, in Hiram's case, he had such a ridiculously huge vocabulary of music, and great, you know, of course, obviously, great facility on the instrument, on guitar, but, you know, great command of that instrument, and great control over it, but he... could play anything that he heard, you know, and the reason that he heard a lot of stuff was that he had this huge dictionary, this huge vocabulary to choose from. And he was probably, and I don't want to sound racist here, but I've said this a million times in public, that Hiram was probably the only African American that I ever knew recite the entire Crosby, Stills, and Nash songbook, note for note, lyric for lyric. The entire Steely Dan songbook, the entire, you know, real book, bebop, with all the lyrics and all the chords on, and I'm talking about not only guitar, but could sit at the piano and do this as well, which is, to me, unbelievable. I mean, I would die to be able to do that. Plus, you know, every crazy bebop thing, and, you know, he fit right into the Jaco band perfectly because he could get as crazy as anybody he played with. And the Hiram Bullock stage that if you were invited to be on it, if you were part of the Hiram Bullock realm, that was an open, it was open season for creativity. You know, he just let anything be anything, and you could play anything and he could make music out of your most mundane idea. You could make a mistake and he would turn that into a thing because his vocabulary allowed him to, you know, he had so much reference to bounce off of musically that he could give your lamest crap validity.
Life, yeah, it became something.
It was incredible. You know, and a guy like the late Lou Soloff, a big piece of him went away when Hiram died. Hiram went away, and now Lou Soloff didn't have that playground that he once had to go and make this instant music. And a lot of this came from Gil Evans' influence too. Gil Evans had told Lou Soloff there are no wrong notes. You know, and Lou took that. He took that to
religion.
Heart.
Yeah.
You know, he just let anything happen. Anything could fly with Lou. When Lou got on stage to play with you, you were going to stop at what you were doing, and you were going to pay attention to that guy that just got up on that stage because he wasn't going to leave you alone. You know, if I'm talking to an audience member, mm-hmm. being on stage was a whole other thing. You were like, oh shit, here we go. But the audience was like, whoa, that's cool. You know, so you had to just go with it because he was going to go take you to some place that you didn't think you were going to go to. And because Hiram was the way he was, that was the perfect scenario for a guy like Lou Soloff to walk in on. So that for that reason, he would sit in with us a lot, mm-hmm. you know, even went to Japan with us a couple of times, you know, and it was always magic. It was always really cool.
I have that Give It What You Got record.
That was an Atlantic thing.
Yeah,
that was
Atlantic,
one of these two Atlantic records, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And I think I told you once I have something else you played on that's Ray Gomez.
Yeah, Volume.
That's a great
right?
record. Yeah.
Ray's a ridiculous
That
player,
guy
man.
Is such an unsung guitar god, man. I mean, I don't know why he's not famous, you know? Well, I know why. I mean, why is it... there's a lot of great players, but you listen to him and you're like, shit, this guy's a great singer too. I was going to ask you earlier when we were talking about Hiram, during that period, or even before when you came for Dreams and all, during that period, did you ever run into, I'm sure you did, but do you have any Jocko stories or any, did he hang out at gigs or crash gigs? Or
Absolutely, man. He was just the sweetest guy, you know. I mean, to see him play live, a lot of times he would come in and just crash your gig. Like, used to drive Mac Rebinac crazy. Yeah, he would just show up on stage with us. He would be, oh boy, here we go. He even wrote a song about it on a Jocko tribute record that we did after his death.
Really?
Yeah, it was hilarious. I mean, he just spilled his guts out about, you know, he'd just show up anywhere.
Mac did?
Step on your gig. You know, that was kind of in the lyrics. But, you know, he was the sweetest soul. And he was always really encouraging to me about my playing. I could have easily just folded as soon as he walked in the door, but he didn't let me.
But you were a Florida boy too, you know.
Yeah, so. But I didn't know him until after I left. I'd never heard of him until after I was gone. Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden there was this buzz. Hey, Jocko.
But Jocko. Still, you were in New York. You were a Florida boy still to him. You know, where are you from? Florida.
Maybe,
oh, cool.
And he loved my dad.
It was probably that, yeah.
I my
mean,
dad.
You're playing, obviously, too, but that... The camaraderie of the Southern thing.
Yeah, probably. We both like the same kind of stuff, music and stuff. But he, I got this call from my dad about a year or two after I left Miami. And this is when Jocko was starting to get really hot down in Florida. My dad called me up and said, hey, man, I'm going to start the, because my dad was dean of the University of Miami School of Music at this time. And he was putting the faculty together and he was creating all the programs. He started the music engineering program and he started the music merchandising was a thing that you could get a degree in. All kinds of creative stuff. And one of them was hadn't had an electric bass department, but he was going to start one and asked me if I would be the head of the electric bass department. And I said, well, Dad, man, I'm kind of killing it up here in New York. I got to say no. I don't want to move back, you know. So he calls Jocko. And Jocko was that guy. He was the first head of the electric bass department, University of Miami.
I didn't know that's how it all happened.
Yeah.
That's funny, man.
That's how that part of it happened. That's how he knew my dad.
Wow.
And the funniest thing about that whole Jocko being the head of the bass department thing is, and I've heard it from three different guys that were in his, that were underneath, under Jocko in his, you know, teachings there. And they would have lessons with him. And everybody tells the same story. Mark Egan, Frank Gravis, another New York bassist, that these had all been University of Miami guys, and Hiram. They all took lessons from Jocko during during his run of being the head of the electric bass department. You'd go into the room, and he would say, okay, play this groove, man. And he would have you play something, you know, probably something like the Chicken. And he would, and you would play that, and he would solo for an hour.
And that was the last one.
Okay, see you next week, man. Which is pretty funny. But it has to be the most valuable lesson for a bassist, because that's your gig.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's to do that while the music's playing, you know. That is the actual, the gig isn't, you know, the gig isn't the solo stuff. The gig is playing bass. So not only did you get a lesson in how to keep and hold a groove for an hour, you got to hear Jaco Pastorius in person for 1 hour.
Yeah. See you next
week.
Holy
shit.
Yeah.
To have been a fly on that wall.
Speaking of fly, Nightfly. I didn't ask you about Nightfly. Classic record, man. Do you have a favorite track on that?
Oh God. I don't have the song list in front of me, but every song on that is,
yeah, that's just
when I'm
like,
listening to that record, you know, and many, you can say that about a lot of the Steely records. They just sound so timeless because they were recorded so meticulously, and they still sound fresh for that reason, you know.
But the Nightfly, that was done, was that done in L.A.? Was that you and Gad, or is that Picaro?
That song?
The whole record.
Oh, it was all piecemeal, you know.
Okay.
They would take a piece of...
Yeah, like Steely Dan.
They would take a Steve Jordan bass drum and mix it with a Jeff hi-hat and put it through the windle or whatever, and next thing you know, you had a drum track that was kind of like every note was produced.
Yeah.
And carefully, you know, separated out and put in.
Anyway.
My only experience, I mean, I came in and did that one song, Walk Between the Raindrops. You know, super muted.
Yeah.
A shadow crossed the blue Miami sky. As we hit the causeway by the big hotels, we fought. Now
and
I can't remember.
I came in again to do Ruby Baby.
Yep.
You know, and I came in and I played. Help me. What key? We're in G, right? So I was thumbing it. I was in the control room thumbing it. And anytime anybody would hear any kind of fret sound or anything in the studio, a hand would fly up. And it would go back to the beginning of the song.
You'd have to play the whole... They couldn't just punch it in.
And they would hear it. If they heard anything, hand would fly up, go back to the beginning.
Holy shit.
My bad. I should have been out in the studio doing this. They wouldn't have heard any of that stuff. But they were going... This went on for 3 days. At the end of the third day, I said, guys, you got it. I can't keep doing this. I was going insane. So I walked out on that session, and then Anthony Jackson came in. Or whatever. Played it with his fingers. Fine. Next. I could have taken him a week. I have no idea. But I lost it. But the other thing had been a breeze, you know. The Walk Between the Raindrops.
Man, those are like legendary. Those Steely Dan stories are legendary for being super meticulous and picky and kind of jumping around, but you always strike me as a kind of guy who's, you know, you're always very up and positive and you're a very forward thinking guy. And a lot of people, since I've been in New York, everything is about the past. You know, that's not like it was. That's not like, oh man, you should have been here. Oh, you missed this.
I hate that.
Yeah. So I want to get your take on, because you were here in the quote heyday, whatever, six sessions a day, whatever you guys were doing for years. Everybody knows all those stories. What's your attitude on that now? Like, I guess the question would be, you don't ruminate on the past in those days. I mean, if there was somebody that was going to move to New York now, would you encourage it or would you just, you know, tell them to be cautious? Or
it depends on what they wanted to do. You know, if they wanted to be a studio musician, I would just laugh because,
right,
you know, of course I would laugh at myself if I said I want to be a studio musician at this point, because there's no such thing. So everything's a one-off basically, unless you start a thing that starts to catch on with the public and it gets momentum, you know, like a band or something. And I never looked back. I mean, I never, as much as I talk about the Beatles and all that kind of stuff, I'm not wishing things were the way they were ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like looking ahead because that's how things get done, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason I started the Fab Four, the Beatles band, wasn't because I wanted to have an oldies band or I wanted to have a cover band of any kind. I just liked the Beatles music so much that I think, for me, I think that the Beatles music is so important, and I know it is, and I know why it is, and it informed all this other stuff that's happened ever since. You know, like you said, you can hear it in pop music all the time, and you can't say that about a lot of other bands' stuff. As much as you may like the Stones, as much as you might like Elton John or anybody else you can think of, you know, there's nothing that really has really steered the course of mighty rivers the way the Beatles music did. You know, I had, when I was at 11 years old at the time when the Beatles did the Ed Sullivan Show, I remember I had a girlfriend back in Texas and her name was Anita, and at one point, it got to the point where she saw that I was so obsessed with the Beatles. She said, "All right, is it me or the Beatles?" And I said, "Well, you're amazing." However, if I have to make a choice, you know.
Yeah, it's just no.
I couldn't just ignore the Beatles.
Do you have a Hofner? Do you have a Hofner?
Compression. Yeah. For days, I was convinced that the song "She Said, She Said," you know that one?
Yeah, yeah.
She said,
yeah.
I know. I was thinking, okay, he's playing it with his hands, because every cymbal hit just like.
Yeah, they're real. Yeah, not like washy. They bloom. Yeah, they're like
to the point where I was trying to get Fab Four. I was trying to get our drummer to do it with his hands, and I called up. I said. I called him Mark Hudson, you know that guy? He was producing Ringo at the time, anyway.
The producer, yeah, the guy with the, like, the multicolored thing, yeah.
And I said, "Hey, man, can you do me a favor? Just lean over, would you ask Slayer?" I said, "Can you ask Ringo, did he play that with his hands?" "Sticks," I heard it from the background. Okay, I lost that argument.
Thank you, Will, for doing this.
Thank you so much, Shane. A pleasure, man. I'm glad we could finally do it.
I know. Well, thank you for making the time, man. You want to just play us out? We'll play something in a groove. Anything.
You know what? I'd like to just play some bebop.
What do you want to play?
Some blues?
Yeah. What key?
Just a B flat blues.
Sure.
getting kind of smoky in here.
Yeah.
I feel like putting my pajamas on, man.
The red velvet couch.
Yeah, ain't nothing but the blues. Nothing but the blues. Nothing but the blues. Nothing but the blues. Oh, I got nothing but the blues, and I'm afraid of you. I always wanted to play upright, but no, without an upright.
Pretty convincing, man.
Walking the dog, just walking the dog, just walking the dog. Good night.
Cool, man. Thank you, Will.
Yeah, baby.
All right. Thanks for listening. If you want more, there's one more little clip where Will talks about some tips for a special interest to musicians trying to create a scene. It's just so much great stuff. I just wanted to include it. Again, all I ask is you please leave me a good review on iTunes. You know, spread the word. I don't try to make any money on any of these podcasts or anything. But they are a ton of work to do. So I love hearing from you guys. And I will shamelessly plug my new record. It's called Still Motion. It's available CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon, and my website, ShaneTerrio.com. Once again, thanks to Will Lee. And thank you for listening. Bonus coming up.
I don't want people to hear it and go, you interviewed Will Lee and you didn't ask him, blah, blah, blah. You know.
Well, let me think if there's anything that I should. I mean, we laughed at people who said they wanted to be studio musicians in New York, but that's not very nice.
Studio musicians anywhere, really, unless
right.
Maybe Nashville, maybe. I don't know. Still things.
Oh, you
still...
I wanted to talk about David Garfield a little bit.
Sure, man. Go for it.
Because David Garfield, you know, you mentioned that Tribute to Jeff album.
Yes.
Right. Yep. Are we rolling?
Yeah.
Okay. Put away the cue cards. I don't need the cue cards for this. I'm just going to improvise. David Garfield is this guy who I always like to refer to whenever anybody says, you know, how do I get a gig? How do I make it in the music business? Well, first of all, Hiram Bullock said, if you want to make money, be a banker. If you do music for the money, boy, that's, can that backfire on you? You know, that's a really crazy
sure.
idea.
Yeah.
But it's possible that you can make money in music, but it's not the norm, you know. But David Garfield is a guy from St. Louis, Missouri, who somehow made his way to L.A., didn't really know the guys, knew who the guys were, and would put together these projects, you know. He would call, because, you know, musicians, we're whores, you know, we want to play. We're hoes. We just want to fucking play.
Right.
So get, you know, set me up and I'll and count it off and I'll start playing, basically, right? So he would call, like, Vinny Colaiuta. Hey, man, are you free to do a thing? Blah, blah, blah. Vinny go, yeah, sure. Who else are you going to call? And he would say, I don't know. I'm going to call blah, 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 blah. And then we'd call up Lukather. Hey, Steve, can you do a thing? You know, are you available such and such a night? Vinny wants to do it, so blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know, he's gone from like, who the hell is, who's David Garfield to like, hey, I'm doing that David Garfield gig, you know? Oh, me too, whatever. And then, you know, next thing you know, he would start like, because he would start calling the guys that he wanted to play with, you know, he would start a little network going. And now he's in the network, you know. And now people know who David Garfield is, you know, fast forward to today. And it's because he not only created like gigs, for instance, the tribute to Jeff, that was a big thing. Everybody came on board.
Yeah.
He does a yearly Carlos Vega Memorial gig in L.A. He's been doing it for, I don't know, ever since Carlos passed. You know, I mean, he's a very, very sensitive guy who, you know, and he doesn't do it. He's not motivated because, you know, oh, let me be like an ambulance chaser and take advantage of somebody's death. You know, that's the worst way to look at it. But he would be able to find a common thing that would pull at people's heartstrings the way his heartstrings were being pulled on when somebody passed away. So a guy like Carlos is very beloved. Jeff Porcaro, very beloved. And so people would want to come together, and he would be sort of the conduit that would get people to show up at a place where they could all spill their hearts out for the loss of somebody, you know? So that was one example of like a guy who was resourceful enough to bring people together and get himself as part of the scene. You know, that, I don't know how you can exactly say that's what's going to happen, but that's ended up being what happened for him. You know, mm-hmm. Now he's part of the scene.
He created his own opportunity.
He didn't wait for the phone to ring, in other words. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you got to go out. If you want to get a scene happening, sometimes you have to become the motivator. You can't always just be the guy, oh, Jesus, I'm not getting any work. And you got to make it happen sometimes, you know. And it's doable. It's very possible to get a thing started and just do something. Just do something. Get up and do something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir.
No, man. I think that's good advice, though, because, you know, I get guys ask me sometimes, too, what should I do? What should I do? You know, I just moved here. And I go, well, you ever think about putting your own thing together and maybe put a little money into it at first, but hire X and Y and blah, 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 because then you become a guy. You're not, like you said, you're not waiting around.
Yeah, invest
and then,
in yourself.
Then the other musicians are like, oh, all of a sudden you're in charge because you're getting guys work, you know? So you're looked at from a different angle, a favorable angle, rather than, oh, this guy's hounding me for a gig again. You're giving them gigs, you know?
Right.
It's a good strategy to have, I think, as a musician, nowadays especially.
Yeah, because you got to get something happening. I mean, you love music. You want to be a part of it. You want to play. You want to keep your chops up. You know, you want to communicate with other humans. You want to, if you have anything at all to say, you want to have an audience that wants to hear what you have to say. So part of getting your craft together and shedding or loving music in the first place is getting out there and expressing something. And there are multiple ways to do it. And maybe the studio scene is not one of them, and as like it used to be, mm-hmm. you know. But there are scenes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.